brute force. If it doesn't work, you're just not using enough. You're listening to Soft Web Radio, Special Operations Military News, and Straight Talk with the Guys in the Community.
Soft Rep Radio, on time, on target. I am so excited for this episode. Robert Baer is back on with us for the first time in, I think, 4 years. But before we get into it, this show is brought to you by Crate Club, a club for men, by men, of gear handpicked by Special Operations military veterans. Visit crateclub.us for an exclusive promotion for our listeners of 20% off any gearbox of your choice. This is the biggest discount we've ever made available, and we don't know how long we can keep this promotion alive. So go to crateclub.us, use the coupon code SOFTREP, and get 20% off any gearbox. That's crateclub.us. Coupon code SOFTREP for 20% off any gearbox. Sign up today. Bob Baer coming on with us, one of the most respected CIA case officers out there from 76 to 97. But before we get to that interview, I guess the big news today is that this is not any surprise to people, but as was heavily speculated on, Joe Biden is officially running for president in 2020. And yep. It's going to shake things up. It's going to make things interesting. As you kind of noted as we were prepping for this show, the feedback from at least the, I guess you would say, progressive or woke base on Twitter is like they're not happy about this guy running. They want someone that they see as more progressive.
Yeah, you know, when I was on a Brian Kilmeade show just before coming over here to do our own podcast, and
which I really quick, I should have told you to go because I was just around there. I should have told you to go to Tri-Tip at the Rockefeller Center building. You've been there with me, but I've been going there every morning that I'm here now because it's like the best breakfast burrito ever. And now I'm addicted to them, and it's right by there. But anyway.
Okay, I'll go there next time.
So good. So any of you who are ever in New York City, go to Tri-Tip. They're not a sponsor, but Tri-Tip's breakfast burritos are like out of this world.
The fill-in host, Mary.
Yeah, Barry Walter.
Yeah, she asked me, she's like, you know, do you think that there's going to be an attraction to so-called democratic socialism with millennials? Like, do you think that's going to speak to the population? I'm like, no, like these, like the woke mentality, the whole ideology, that's like it's a Twitter phenomenon. It's not real life. And yeah, millennials, I mean, young people are going to be much more liberal than older people. Like we've seen that demographic shift, you know, that's just a constant thing. But I mean, democratic socialism is just communism with fucking clowns and balloons. So it's like, I mean, these millennials are going to grow up. They're going to have to pay taxes and be gainfully employed. And as that happens, they're going to become more conservative, or if not saying they're going to become Republicans, but they're going to drift towards the center because this stuff just doesn't, I mean, it doesn't resonate with mainstream society.
I mean, they may become, you know, continue to be idealistic, though, because there have been a ton of surveys done on, you know, younger people in general and things like freedom of speech, and they don't value it as much as older generations. They do believe in, you know, the government cracking down on what they call hate speech. And, you know, that goes against
They believe in subjective reality. They think what I feel is what's true. You know, they will tell you, I know my truths, which is horrifying to me. Like, no, that's not what we're talking about here. You don't get to have your own little world to live in, and you become the arbiter of what is true and what is not. Like, sorry, pal. And as you were telling me before we started recording, like they're going to lose this election because they're trying to throw Biden under the bus. He is the only chance they have to defeat Trump.
So I think I've referenced this rant several times on here, but it was just one of the truest things I heard. I am a Ben Shapiro fan. And what he said, and he's talked about this, is that the only way to stand out in this field, because it's going to end up being a field of like 20 people or something, of everybody. I mean, I'm sure, I don't know if someone like Andrew Yang is going to get in the debates, but I think it's going to be a ton of people. And the only way to stand out is to outleft the rest of the people.
Right, right. You got to say crazy shit.
Yeah, you're not going to stand out being the moderate. And he's like, they could win this election if they could just not sound crazy. and they can't help themselves.
Yeah, yeah.
And so the latest example of this, and this sounds almost like crazy fake news stuff, but you can go out there. This is actually happening. They asked Bernie Sanders about voting rights for felons, which is something he's been an advocate for. And they asked him, you know, all felons, does this include rapists? And does it include someone as horrific as, you know, Tsarnaev, of the Boston Marathon bomber? And he believes that, yes, he should have his right to vote, you know, reinstilled. And then, you know, a candidate who's looked at as less radical than Bernie Sanders, I would say, Kamala Harris, she did a town hall, I believe it was, with Don Lemon, and asked her about, you know, he said that Bernie Sanders has recently said that we need to reinstill voting rights for felons, including people as radical as the Boston Marathon bomber. And she started saying, I've been a federal prosecutor, and I've worked hard on this issue, and I do believe, like, those among us, you know, in these situations should be able to have the right to vote at a certain point when they've, you know, paid their dues to society. You know, and Don Lemon said, but does this include someone as radical as the Boston Marathon bomber? And she said it's something we need to discuss.
Well, I mean, if they've paid their dues to society and have been released from prison, yeah. I mean, I can see there should
be a
process.
But he flat out asked her, even the Boston Marathon bomber. And she said, yeah, we need to discuss this. And
Like Tim McVeigh, should he be able to vote, you know?
If he was alive, yeah. But here's what I don't get and why they're tackling this issue. It makes no sense to me because essentially an election is, you know, popularity contest, and you're supposed to, whether you're on the right or the left, you're supposed to champion issues that America could get behind,
right? Right.
And kind of hide those more radical views unless, you know, in the primary they're running to the left to get that Democrat base. But I could tell you, I hang out with plenty of New York, you know, progressives, they label themselves, and all different types of people. I don't know anyone who's championing, honestly, for the Boston Marathon bomber to have the right to vote. I've never met anyone who said that this is what we need.
No, all that woke Twitter subculture is just that. Like,
I don't even know if those people would advocate for this.
I don't know if, I mean, like, you know, BK said when he came on here, he's like, man, half of them don't even believe that shit themselves. They just say it because they're trying to get little hearts in it, and they're getting that little, like, adrenaline high off of it. It's crazy, man.
But I actually do think Kamala Harris is a serious what's the candidate?
Yeah.
Losing my train of thought. It's for a president. Why is she saying that? Why this is not going to win you votes? I don't get why she would agree with a statement like that.
They all want to one up each other, and you know it's going to turn into like Hugo Chavez, and it'll be like, if you vote for me, you will get free milk and eggs, you know, like all kinds of shit.
Yeah.
It's just going to like get more and more goofy as time goes on.
So I was going to say, personally, I really do think for a statement like that to both of them, throw punch of the week.
Fuck them.
I don't know anybody who wants to see someone who took the lives of innocent people just trying to run a marathon. And somehow that person is given the right to vote.
No, you're absolutely right, Ian, that like this is not pragmatic politics. Like they are not thinking about what they need to do to get the votes to win the election. They're thinking about like, oh, this is going to get, you know, this is like the next Twitter hashtag. It's like, no, that's not how you win an election, bro.
Yeah.
It's not how it's done.
Although I'll come from the other side on here, you know, in a heated primary, people thought Donald Trump was saying too crazy of stuff to win his primary. And the people who did sound pragmatic, you know, the Jeb Bushes of the world,
they got pushed out.
They did not catch on. So.
And I think that probably does play into the thought process. They think they're going to run a social media election like AOC. You know, I think they all wish they were like her right now. And they had that kind of like massive social media following.
Yeah. I don't know how much we can get to here because we have emails and I know you got to get going here. We have a very long email that I won't read the whole thing about, but this guy Mike, who's a veteran, U.S. military veteran living in Israel, basically commented on us talking about Netanyahu and the election. I'm not going to be able to get to the whole thing because it's just very long and we have limited time today. But my friend Avery sent me this article that I thought was really interesting from the Times of Israel, if you want to check it out, called "The Kids Are All Right Wing, Why Israel's Younger Voters Are More Conservative." And the interesting thing about this article is it's kind of like the antithesis of what we just talked about. And because this article shows polling and people 18 to 24 overwhelmingly are for Netanyahu over the more liberal candidates. And I say candidates because Israel has all these different parties of people running. And it's a long article, but here I'll read this little excerpt here that might bring some understanding to why this is. Young Israelis grew up during the second Intifada, which saw hundreds of Israelis killed in suicide bombings. The aftermath of the 2005 disengagement from Gaza, which occurred when the group was between 4 to 20 years old, has led many young Jewish Israelis to resent any leader who is willing to cede any more land currently under Israeli control. Since some of this group have served in the army, successive wars in Gaza have only hardened that perception. This is a quote from... I'd have to read back to see who this guy is, Herman, but he says they were born after the Oslo process started. They were exposed to the bloodshed during the second Intifada. They're coming right after military service. And then it says
a war generation.
Yeah. So it for the further quote here from a Likud spokesman, which is Netanyahu's party. People who grew up in the middle of the Al-Aqsa Intifada don't trust the Palestinians, don't believe in peace. They really want to be there for want there to be peace, but there is no partner. For younger religious Zionist voters in particular, the disengagement, which displaced some 8,000 Jewish settlers, was considered an absolutely devastating moment that they have vowed never to return to. The general narrative is, we gave up this land, they sent rockets in return. The national religious have considered it a national trauma ever since then. There's been no peace process, no handshakes, no agreements. Any negotiations have been zero expectation negotiations. But along with the children of the conflict, this cohort is shaped by their religiosity. A larger percentage of young Israelis are Haredi Orthodox, I actually don't know how to pronounce that, and religious Zionist more so than previous generations, and religious Jewish Israelis tend to be more right-wing. So I just thought this was interesting because it's very different from America, where 18 to 24, they would overwhelmingly vote for whoever the left-wing candidate is.
I mean, not to make a apples and oranges comparison, but another way to think about that is what we've done in America, that we are on a permanent war footing. Like you're talking about how you have this generation of young people who... Israel has always been at war, right? Their entire life, they're in a security state, and that's one of my fears about the war on terror, and that it has no end in sight. That like now you have kids who just grow up, and you don't have to propagandize them and convince them to go to war or that the war is bad or good or anything. It's like it's just there and it's always there. It's a paradigm. It's a new way of living and being an American. That it's always there in the background.
Yeah. All right, and before we get to Bob Baer, one last thing. We have a voice memo from our friend Gene Farnsworth, and everybody loves hearing from Gene, so I feel like I might as well get to that. And we haven't done one in a while, and I know that you sent him a review copy of the book, so that's what this gets into.
Oh, cool.
Let's hear it.
Greetings, my subscription mates. Gene Farnsworth here, USN, retired. Looks like a very exciting time coming up for Soft Rep. Lots of good things seem to be happening. Really have been enjoying Jack's book. I'm about halfway through it. Freaking kick ass. He's smuggling into Syria now. It was really, really interesting reading the high-speed chase in Mosul. Definitely puts a person right in the cab of that freaking Humvee. Amazing. Really good book. Congratulations, Jack. I hope it does as well as is written. And Ion... I always say it wrong, and I apologize, but it's been good listening to you. I think you've done a hell of a good job, and I'm sure you'll be missed by the Soft Rep folks. And good luck in your next chapter in your life. May you all continue to have fair winds and following seas. Gene out.
Gene's voice memo quality there is, like, better than usual. I don't know what he's using, but it sounds good. But, no, so appreciated. Always love hearing from Gene Farnsworth.
No, I love hearing from Gene, and thank you so much for reading the book. It's interesting. He's actually the second person today to bring up that chase scene. It was in a Stryker armored vehicle, And we were chasing after a Opel, like a sedan in Mosul that supposedly had a high level target. Oh, I'm sure it was the guy we were looking for because he took off at a high rate of speed once he saw us. And the private driving the Striker, it's like a 23-ton armored vehicle. I mean, it's fucking huge. He just like floors it in these like twisting, winding streets of Mosul. I don't know how fast he got us going, like 70 miles an hour or something. Just like, and there's a huge, it's a fucking tank, basically. And it's like I'm there in the hatch outside the vehicle, you know, and I'm just like getting rocked back and forth as he's cutting around these corners. And it's like most people, I think it's like the average American just has no idea what it's like to have your life be completely in the hands of an 18-year-old private driving a 23-ton armored vehicle in a high-speed chase. It's just like, oh, my God.
But, the adrenaline has to be insane.
Yeah, yeah. But no, thank you, Gene. I'm glad you're enjoying the book. Let me know what you think of it when you finish.
Now that I'm wondering, like, how do you sleep after a night of after that?
Like a baby.
Really?
In Egyptian cotton sheets, my friend.
I'm just wondering.
It's good to be alive.
Well, we have Bob Baer standing by. I'm so excited to have him on. One of the most respected guys you'll hear from the CIA. So much history there. So let's get right into it. Joining us back on the podcast for the first time in a very long time, the last time Robert Baer was on was with the release of The Perfect Kill, 21 Laws for Assassins, which is still the latest book, but it's been out for a while. But glad to have back on the show author and former CIA case officer from 1976 to 1997, Robert Baer. Very excited to speak with you.
Hey, it's great to be back after all this time.
So this is the first time you've been on with Jack Murphy, but I got to speak with you. And when I called you and was seeing if you're up for doing this again, I was wondering what we could get into. And we got into a discussion about basically people in intelligence and even people in special operations working with hostile powers. And I figured, yeah, that's a great topic to get into.
Yeah, and we've brought it up here on the podcast a number of times in regards to Yemen, the UAE, China even.
Yeah, well, I mean, the market out there is bad. I mean, if you're retiring from the military and you're not a general, you got to take work as it comes along.
Is that the same in the Central Intelligence Agency for people who are retiring?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, if you retire, let's say, as an SIS, you still can't afford to put your kids through college, you know? If you got a couple of kids, it just doesn't make it. Or you look at the Washington area. It's just the prices are out of control. Mm-hmm. And I see people over and over again leaving, even short of retirement, simply to move on and make some money to, you know, pay, you know, not to get rich, but to, you know, pay for expenses of living in an urban area.
Is that even like a problem for espionage as far as, you know, guys flipping to the other side? I mean, it makes them vulnerable to that sort of elicitation, doesn't it?
Well, we've seen the case with the UAE. These people from the National Security Agency, mm-hmm. a couple of contractors went there and provided some hacking tools, which undoubtedly were used to track Khashoggi and get into his texts and email. And there's no evidence that they participated in his murder, but it's our tools that are being carried out at the NSA or the CIA that are ending up being used for bad purposes.
And there's one in particular, isn't it, Larry Sanchez, a former CIA officer who is over in the UAE doing a lot of advising with them?
Yeah, well, it's Sanchez, but it's also Morrell.
Oh, really?
Former acting CIA director.
Michael Morrell.
Mike Morrell, he was acting director, and then he got out, and he helped negotiate the deal with DynCorp in Saudi Arabia to provide the services for the royal court for, you know, spec ops and things like that.
And also...
I mean, look, the revolving door has never gone away, and all these people, when they come out, have a, you know, experience and knowledge that are very useful to foreign countries. But once you give them that knowledge, you can't account for what they do with it.
That was the conversation I had with a number of people after the various American special operations veterans, including Dale Comstock, that whole story in, when they were working in Aden under the auspices of the Emirati military, that the UAE is really desperate for capabilities. They want the capabilities of JSOC, of the Central Intelligence Agency, but they don't necessarily have the maturity to know what to do with those capabilities.
Well, it's a one-man rule there. That's the problem. It's like Saudi Arabia, and both leaders, de facto leaders, are, you know, they're playing around with international law, violating it more like. But it's and you know, it's with this president doesn't seem to care that Saudi Arabia, the crown prince, chopped up a Washington Post columnist. I mean, it's just, you know, it's sort of like Russia. We've just all moved on. That's the new rules. And if you want to, you know, there are no more rules anymore. That's what I'm trying to say.
It's interesting that, I mean, former American officials, whether military or from the intelligence community, going over there. I mean, I know that if I were to go overseas and provide military training to certain countries and certain people, that would be a violation of ITARs, which doesn't just cover arms trafficking. It also covers military training. I wonder, I mean, we haven't really seen anyone prosecuted, though.
I don't think we will either, like those guys in Haiti. I knew one of them. They go there, hired by the president in what could be considered a lethal operation because they were carrying weapons in Port-au-Prince. And they were going to take delivery of some money and transport it out of the country. As it turned out, it was illegal. It wasn't the president's money. Now, they think they were working for a sovereign state, but in fact, it was more complicated than that. And those guys, none of them, there's been no indictments against them. So are the guys in Yemen. I mean, you can go there and carry out lethal operations, and the Department of Justice is going to be loath to prosecute you.
Well, who were they working for, if not for the Haitian government? You're saying it was more a private embezzlement scheme?
Well, yeah, it sounded like the president was embezzling this fuel fund and carrying the cash out. I mean, Haiti is not exactly, you know, Switzerland. So that's, they were stopped by a guard who called up whoever is directly in charge of the fund and stopped it, and they all got arrested. And the State Department worked to get them out of Haiti, and they did. It's an ambiguous situation because in a country like Haiti, you don't really know who's in charge. And if you're being hired for an operation like this, even though you think you're reporting to a sovereign authority, in fact, you're not. I mean, a lot of parts of the world, it's unclear who's really in charge of these countries, whether it's Saudi Arabia or a lot of countries in South America. You know, as there's a disintegration of law generally around the world, it becomes very complicated.
Yeah, and I mean, even with, you know, the guys in Yemen, they put themselves under the auspices or seconded to the Emirati military, and they think they're covered then under the law. But really, you're not. I mean, that could be construed as mercenary activity. It could be construed as a number of things.
Yeah, and you could get hauled in for war crimes,
yes,
investigation out of The Hague, any number of things, because you're ultimately acting as a mercenary. I mean, even though the UAE is a nominal ally of this country, you're still operating as a mercenary, just as the NSA people did that worked at Abu Dhabi. And they brought that software to them. And you know, it's dangerous. I mean, some of the software you can put into an iPhone through iMessaging, it just has to sit in queue, like a text from iMessaging will sit in queue for 5 seconds and it'll put malware into your phone. I think they've closed that gap, but that's the kind of technology that can't be produced indigenously in these countries, and former employees are selling it essentially.
And I wonder then what you think, which this is raises even more eyebrows for me personally. And I know there's a question of semantics, but the issue of Eric Prince working with the Chinese government in some capacity.
Well, I mean, no one seems to care. It's to look at it the least, the worst way, he's out there building concentration camps for Muslims. Now, he doesn't know anything about it, but he's working for the Chinese, and he's worked for the Chinese in Africa, and he's worked for the UAE. And it all gets sort of messy, especially when Prince is in touch with a Russian oligarch who effectively worked for the Russian government. I mean, who's in charge in Russia? It's hard to tell. Is it Deripaska, the guy that owns the aluminum monopoly, or is it Putin, or is it Russian intelligence? I don't know anymore. I mean, so much stuff is getting outsourced to corporations or parastatal bodies that it's hard to tell. In the old days, a Soviet was a Soviet, but now it's hard to tell what's going on in the world. I mean, if you could go work for the Chinese, why couldn't you go work for the Russians in Moscow?
Yeah.
Because they're getting deep into Africa through oligarchs, and they're providing mercenary forces as they did in Syria. Which, by the way, we almost got in the middle of a war with these Russian mercenaries when they moved on one of our forward operating bases. So it's becoming very dicey out there.
Yeah, I mean, especially in Syria, it seems like those flashpoints could have erupted at any moment. I mean, I think in the incident you were referring to, there's a Russian mercenary company moving on an oil field and a FOB that the SDF controlled, where there are American troops. And as I read about anyway, we called up on the hotline, we called the Russians and said, hey, are those your boys moving on us? And they were like, nope. So we just called in air and artillery on them and killed all of them. And something like that could erupt into a war, I mean, very easily.
Yeah, I mean, it's like we're up against the Iranians, and the Iranians are operating through paramilitary organizations, militias, the Hashda Shabi, as it's called. And everybody's using these proxies for plausible deniability. Yeah, it's just getting very confusing.
Well, is there, a real concern? I mean, Eric Prince allegedly ran a number of covered programs for the intelligence community back in the day, doing some interesting activities. I mean, is there a real concern that he could take that kind of know-how over to communist China and help them develop similar capabilities?
Well, I look at it more, with his sister sitting in the cabinet as sort of approval of the White House. Mm-hmm. He's, there's a big move into Libya right now supporting Khalifa Haftar for the oil resources. Now, on one side, you got the State Department that has that's backing the UN-backed government in Tripoli, and then you got this guy Haftar, who's supported by the Russians, and various Americans that are swirling around Haftar, and Prince was there for a while, too, in Libya. So what is our policy? And then you got the president saying, we share a vision, Haftar and I do. So is it the State Department making policy, or is it Eric Prince or these other people in Libya? And it's very hard to tell.
Well, I was wondering, since you brought it up, I mean, if you knew anything about Haftar, because I think he's an interesting personality in that he was captured during the 88 Toyota War. We got him out of prison down there, and he lived in Virginia for many years, which I know, Bob, you're a smart enough guy. You can put two and two together there. But now he's allied with the Russians. It's like, what's going on with this cat?
Well, he was more run out. The people who did Libyan operations a lot was run out of the White House, started with the Reagan White House. I was involved in that when we wanted to get rid of Gaddafi at mm-hmm. any price. And anybody that came out, whether he was a general or a Muslim brother or whatever, we were on it saying, yeah, get rid of Gaddafi. So, I mean, the good thing, let's be fair, is he's a secular leader. Mm-hmm. I mean, he, if anybody's going to go down, crush these Islamic groups in Libya, and they're still dangerous. But the point is, going back to our original, how we started this is you've got all these sort of private interests out there that's no longer being, led by the State Department. There is not a single foreign policy.
Well, it seems that,
you know, what's our policy on Russia? You know, seriously, I mean, you've got the Russians putting $200 million into Kentucky to McConnell. You know, is it a purchase? I just don't know anymore. It's sort of like corrupt money runs the world, and it didn't used to be this way.
Well, it seems that, you know, back when you first entered government service, there was an ideology that held everything together. I mean, the CIA was an organization of people that came about after World War II and saw the emergence of communism as being just as bad as the Nazis, if not a little worse. And it seems like that was something that held us together, held our foreign policy and our defense infrastructure together. But today, with global superpower threat from a peer adversary, it seems like we're decoupled or untethered from a unifying ideology like that.
Yeah, when I was in the CIA, you know, we were warned over and over again to say, you don't represent the White House. You don't represent the National Security Council. You represent the CIA. You don't represent American policy, even though we were part of the government. We were warned over and over again when we would tell, you know, assets, hey, we can get this message right to the president. And so there was a definite discipline. And under George H.W. Bush, it was one guy ran foreign policy, and that was James Baker. And that was very clear, the old school. And then along comes Clinton, where a lot of people in the White House were running private foreign policy. Mac McLarty was one of them. I don't know if anybody remembers him, but he was
like,
out there.
It sounds like the Dulles brothers,
doing
right?
business.
I was just saying it sounds reminiscent of the Dulles brothers back in the old days.
Yeah, it was. Well, at least the Dulles brothers, you know, had tea in the afternoon together, you know, and could, you know, check notes and things like that and coordinate. But now, you know, it's almost so commercially transactional at this point. And you'd like to say, well, it started with Trump and it's going to go away with him, but that's just not true.
Who do you think?
And
it did
it's
start
a
with?
Revolving door in Washington. I mean, it's just like everybody's saying, you know, you got to get it. You spend a little time in the government, work on your Rolodex, and then go out and make some dough.
Right, right. No, the total, you know, instead of serving your country, you're attaching this sort of capitalist ideal to it, which it can become problematic as you make a mention of.
Yeah, it's you know, it's I don't, you know, that's from a perspective that's old now, but I still feel it every day. And I still look at my colleagues out there trying to make a little bit of money, or, you know, in touch with SEALs or Delta guys or the rest of it. They're just, you know, first of all, they can't go on this global war on terror indefinitely. And, you know, spending 20 years assaulting 3 or 4 houses a night, and then all the PTSD that does, and then get out and say, oh, by the way, you know, you're divorced and you've lost your family, and you don't have enough to live on. You, and the little you do have to live on is going to your divorced wife.
That's,
I mean,
sadly,
that's typical. There's a cost to all this.
And the comparisons to the Roman Empire are kind of cliche, but I mean, it's almost unavoidable, isn't it?
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's, you know, for me, it's like things would be a little bit different if we had a draft.
Very different.
And you wouldn't have this bubble, this elitist bubble in New York and Los Angeles of, you know, well, we don't really do that. We don't serve in the military, you know, because we're going to cheat our way into USC or wherever. And well, that just irritates me, you know. And, you know, in this crap, thank you for your service. You know, I've heard that over and that it's sort of meaningless.
Yeah, it is kind of a throwaway statement, isn't it?
Yeah, they don't care. They don't, and you try to tell, you know, you try to talk about it, and that's enough. We've heard that's, you know, we don't need to know.
Yeah.
And that you're right. Going back to Rome, you get the point where you having a professional military, it becomes detached from the Republic, and it doesn't do us any good in the long term.
Well, it's also that, as you mentioned, we're so comfortable here in America that we don't really have to know what's going on abroad. We can send these operators overseas and they can hit three houses a night, and we don't really have to be engaged in that as a public or take any responsibility for it. You know, we can just deploy that soldier 13, 14, 15 times in a row, and, you know, he's having all kinds of problems, which is completely normal from living that kind of life, but the public itself can disengage from it.
Totally. They don't even care. I mean, they don't even care, you know, that the rules of combat have changed, and it's got a psychological, it's not like World War II, where you have an enemy in a uniform, and when you're going into a place blind, there are civilian casualties, or you're using a drone, there are civilian casualties. So the front lines are not clear cut at all. And, you know, these guys are coming back the same way with the CIA, and they're detached from American foreign policy. And you sit and you read the newspapers, or you talk to people in Washington, and they don't know what they're talking about. And a lot of the CIA problems now, people keep on reiterating this, is they're sent out to, you know, someplace like Khost or Kabul or Baghdad, and they're basically in the green zone. And they're, you know, they get to talk to the Shashlik guy, but otherwise you can't go out in Baghdad or even Beirut now, and without, you know, a couple Suburbans and people following you around, and you just don't get to know a society.
Yep.
Unless you can go out and actually meet them.
Do you think that's like I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Yeah. Well, and plus, you know, when the tours are so short, if they're 6 months, and you're sitting in a base in Iraq for 6 months, how much can you really know?
I was just going to say, I mean, does that represent a failure of the intelligence community at this point, that we have these case officers that are charged with collecting human intelligence, but they can't go and do their job in so many countries now unless they have a bunch of, you know, guys like me, like former Rangers in body armor with M4s rolling out with them? Back, you know, I read your memoir before I joined the military. I mean, you were out there collecting info, collecting intelligence, and I mean, you were really out there by yourself, just flapping in the breeze.
Yeah, I was always out there, even when I was in Iraq. You know, it was just, we're driving in an SUV, unmarked, without plates or anything, and sort of dressed like the locals, the couple of Kalashnikovs. But I mean, certainly you could go in and spend the night with these people and listen to them, which you couldn't do, or I'd lived in Iraq in a cave to hide from MI-24s, you know. But at least I got a sense of the Kurds and the Arabs. I mean, that they were, frankly, they're very untrustworthy, but that was at least some sense, you know. And you can't do that anymore. And a lot of people, it's funny, because I meet CIA people now, and they said, oh, I got into CIA because of your book, because I thought I was going to go out there and, you know, figure out what these societies are about and do, you know, sort of being the cowboy out there. And you can't do that anymore. In fact, I've heard at the CIA, they now start their beginning classes for case officers saying, who's read Bob Baer's book? And, you know, some people raise their hands and they said, well, anybody who thinks we still operate that way can leave right now.
Wow.
The guy that quit said 7 years later, when he quit, they were given the same lecture.
And I've read too some other subsequent books, like what was Mazzetti's book, Way of the Knife, and they talk about one case officer in Pakistan, and he was basically, his whole job was just sitting in an office and running assets via email. At least that's what it sounded like to me.
It is too dangerous. I mean, you can't really blame it on the CIA entirely. It's just dangerous. They can't afford to have somebody kidnapped out
right,
there on
right,
the phone,
right,
or really assassinated. And that's the message that comes down from the White House. No, we don't need a kidnapped CIA guy like Bill Buckley was
right.
in Beirut.
Yeah, that would be
don't
a disaster.
And it just makes you less intelligent.
Wow. I was wondering,
since you were discussing before about guys, even in your community, getting hired by these hostile powers that, we've been talking about, you know, who need to make ends meet, as you're talking about getting out of the military, getting out of intelligence, it's hard to do, especially if you live in a major city. Have you had any propositions for any work that you just didn't feel comfortable doing?
Well, geez, you don't know the truth, because I say what's on my mind. I've had no propositions, clean or unclean. It's funny. No one's ever had, no one, in all these years, no one's ever said, hey, come consult for me.
Hmm.
Which I don't know if that I should take that as a matter of pride, or they look at me as a loose cannon. It's better to step aside. No, I mean, other than entertainment, look, when I first got out of the CIA, my wife and I were approached by a Gulf country to keep tabs on a prince, which we ultimately, once we figured out what it was about, we left. It was in Beirut. And my wife and I looked at each other and said, this is before my book came out, and said, no, we can't do this. You know, it's just, that's not what we're geared for, to go after this guy. And then I told the prince that they were going to nail him. And indeed they did, but we'd left by then.
He was killed.
I've been in a situation where a Gulf country has looked at CIA people as potential assets that they could, and it wasn't even that I knew anything that they were looking at me. They just wanted, they needed an American face on what they were doing.
Right.
And that's all they needed, because what they needed to do was go internally tell the royal family, hey, we got the Americans backing us up on this, even though there was nothing we could do. And that's what they always want to do. Put an American face on whatever you're doing. And that means we got a green light from Washington. And that sells internally.
That's incredibly dangerous.
So if you're a SEAL in Yemen, ex-SEAL, and you're wandering around, they can tell everybody else, the Yemenis, hey, these guys are really representing the United States.
And
the United States has got our back on this, and the locals believe it.
Meanwhile, like that article that came out in Reuters about the NSA folks working for the UAE, it was a senior NSA official, former senior NSA official working that contract, and he was recruiting all his old bros from the NSA and telling them, like, yeah, this thing's been approved by the United States government, when it hadn't.
Yeah. I mean, people don't know. They call them up and say, hey, you know, we've got a license to export this stuff. And I think that's what they were saying with the Khashoggi stuff.
That's crazy. That they
tracked him with. They're going around saying, hey, we got a license. We got a green light from the CIA on this technology, so we're good to go. I mean, it's not like you can get your lawyer to check it out. You can't go into CIA headquarters and wander around saying, hey, is this really approved? So people will just, you know, say whatever to recruit people. And these pawns are usually the ones that go down, and the big guys doing the contracts don't.
I've noticed that as well, that people exploit the secretive nature of the CIA, which it has for a reason, to protect its sources and methods, but the frauds will exploit it. And my favorite example, of course, is Wayne Simmons, who's a Fox News
contributor. Yeah, I was about ready to say his name, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, what did you make of that whole situation, Bob?
Well, I looked at his background, and I'd never heard of anything like that. I've had somebody walk up to me, and that's living in California, and say, hey, I was ex-CIA, and I know this guy, I know that guy. And I didn't really question him, but he turned out to be a total fraud. But he fooled me as an insider. But this guy, Wayne Simmons, was clearly talking about some unit that I knew didn't exist. It's not the way things work. He wasn't very smart about it. But if you sat down and knew some CIA people, you could completely fake it. I've seen people do that with Mossad, too, that weren't in Mossad, that were like, you know, TSA guys at Tel Aviv airport saying they were really, you know, Israeli intelligence, which just is not true. I mean, you see it all the time.
But what I don't get is, I mean, if you were onto him, I feel like, to be honest, Jack, you were onto him before anything came out. You told me years before. I mean, how does he fool a guy like Donald Rumsfeld and become an advisor to the war in Iraq?
Well, I don't know how they do it. I think, I mean, somebody like Rumsfeld doesn't take the time. And, you know, they depend on staff to do due diligence. And I know agency people that are out in the building and they're on contract and they can't even get the agency to say something about somebody out there in public. And some of these people have no connection to the CIA, and there are others out there. I don't want to name them. And some of them were briefly worked there, but pretend they had a career in operations and didn't.
Another favorite is Larry Johnson, who poked his turtle head back out just yesterday to again make the claim that Australia and the UK were somehow involved in the Steele dossier and the whole conspiracy theory. And Larry Johnson is like a conspiracy theorist who, I think he was an agency analyst for like a year in like 1993 or something like this.
Yeah, and then he went to work for the State Department.
Oh my gosh.
I know Larry Johnson, he's very convincing, but I've also heard stories that GCHQ were the ones that tapped Trump's phone. I've heard that going around, but of course there's no evidence for it. And this is in Trump Tower, but there's nothing, a claim like that, you have a big fat piece of evidence is absolutely crucial.
Yeah.
And there just isn't any out there. And you know, it's so funny after the Trump thing, so many people came and says, yeah, Obama tapped his phones. And I said, all right. First, I called up the FBI and said, all right, how many people would it take to tap Trump Tower landlines? He said, oh, it would take about 100, you know, to run a wire room. And it would take, illegally AT&T would have to sign off on this to put actuators on the phone. So it's not going to happen to the FBI. And they can't even agree where they're going to lunch to FBI agents, let alone conspiracy for a lame duck president. And then I checked with Task Force Orange and said, yeah, we could do it, but you'd still need 100 people, you know, in Manhattan to get through fiber optics. And so, it's, you know, conspiracy like that, you just really couldn't carry off. And for the British to illegally tap the landlines of a candidate, that would be very ballsy.
Yeah,
I would find that difficult to believe. But in any case, in all these conspiracy theories, show me some evidence, you know, and I'll start thinking about it.
That's actually interesting that it would take that many people to monitor the landlines coming out of one building. You'd think they'd have some better system.
Yeah, well, they actually have to go to the phone company and put actuators on the lines. That's for the copper.
Mm-hmm.
And for the fiber optics, apparently, I don't know how you do it. You can do this remotely, but you would need a part of the military to agree to break the law. And they know flat out it's a felony. You go to jail for 30 years.
Yeah, you'd have to spike the fiber like the submarines do when they tap fiber.
Yeah, you can bend it or some damn thing, or you can, I don't know what you, it's been explained to me, but it's too complicated. But anyhow, everybody agrees that it would just take a lot of people. And as you know, in the government, you can't keep a secret, especially one this big.
Yeah. Yeah, that kind of like gets into like the same thing with the 9/11 conspiracy theories. It's like, you mean to tell me hundreds of people, you know, tore down facades in these buildings and put explosives in them without anyone knowing about it? Really?
Yeah, put charges.
Okay, buddy.
You know, precisely put in. Running up and down the World Trade Center to take it down. It's so crazy, you don't even know where to start. it's like what the CIA didn't tell the FBI about those two hijackers. Well, that's just sheer incompetence, you know?
Oh, yeah,
a failure of imagination, that's what it was.
Yeah, you're talking about the that documentary that I think the New Yorker put it together with isn't Richard Clark in it and Ali Safwan, and they're talking about the FBI and the CIA not talking to one another about the hijackers.
Well, they knew about that meeting in Kuala Lumpur, and then these guys, one of them went off to Thailand and got a visa, and you know, people just didn't put 2 + 2 together, you know. And I know the people that didn't do it, and they weren't, you know, the sharpest tool in the shed.
Yeah, it's incompetence, not conspiracy.
They just assumed somebody else had told the FBI. And then I asked the FBI, and I said, he said, well, these guys didn't commit a crime. you know, presumably they could get State Department to withdraw their visas and send them out of the country. But in order to do a full, you know, telephone taps and the rest of it, you pretty well have to commit a crime. And even if they had identified them, getting on the airplanes is suspicious. An FBI agent told me this was a sign of the case. They couldn't do anything except follow them once they got to the destination. Of course, that was too late by then. I mean, the FBI arrests people for committing crimes, not for on suspicions. You know, it's too, we forget what the system is.
Yeah, they have to work within our constitutional framework. Do you think the agency was trying to target those guys for eventual recruitment, though, that they were interested in recruiting them as assets?
No, I think that's a rumor. There's no evidence
really?
Of that. I mean, there was no... There would have been a message to the CIA office in Los Angeles or San Diego. I don't even know if there's one in San Diego. Yes, I think there's one. It's a small office saying, hey, let's find a way to meet these guys. And every time I've ever tried to recruit somebody, a terrorist that came to this country on a visitor's visa, we called the local FBI office and they'd actually drive us to the meeting where we'd meet these guys and try to recruit them. Because you need all the metadata, you need to talk to neighbors and whatever you need, or if there's some sort of social, you need the FBI involved. So the CIA does not, as a matter of course, go out and try to recruit these people inside this country.
And
it just doesn't. That's not the culture.
I recall in your book, if I remember correctly, that you were working with somebody in the United States during the Gulf War that you were trying to recruit.
Yeah. I mean, we could do it, but we had these offices in major cities, but they're mainly to talk to businessmen or to look at students mm-hmm. or visitors to the country. And I've worked a bunch of times where the FBI would identify somebody and say, hey, he's going to be here for 2 weeks. Do you guys want to recruit him? And it was a matter of cooperation. So if the counterterrorism center went after the two hijackers in San Diego, that would be totally, completely a black swan. It just doesn't happen.
Right. Unilaterally, they have to coordinate.
They do. And, you know, there may be one person who just, you know, goes rogue and tries, but there's no evidence. And that kind of thing, you know, all the investigation into 9/11, something would have come out by now that there was an attempt to recruit them. So people who say there was are just speculating, mm-hmm. trying to explain incompetence.
Yeah, no, I mean, sadly, you're probably right. It probably is incompetence rather than conspiracy.
Yeah, it's like Sri Lanka, you know. Hey, you guys were given the address of these potential suicide bombers. They were named. The Indians gave it to him on 4 April, Sri Lankans, and some dummy decided, well, you know, these kids are from nice families. It couldn't possibly be.
Yeah. I was actually curious, Bob, the last book that you put out, The Perfect Kill, 21 Laws for Assassins, it's been, I think, nearly 5 years since that has been out. Are you working on any new projects?
I'm trying to write a book proposal, and it's very excruciating because with global warming, everybody's talking about social collapse. A lot of scientists are that, you know, if it gets as bad as a lot of people suspect it will, it's going to involve social collapse. Like Syria was largely, civil war was driven by drought, as it is in Somalia and in Afghanistan and Mali and everything, you just go right down the line. So what would social collapse look like? And I'm working with a guy from Doctors Without Borders who is the liaison with Shabab and the Taliban and things like that. He's a Canadian. So we're trying to put, you know, if things fall apart on the rim or even closer to home, what does it look like? And both of us are spent our careers in failed societies, and we're trying to go there.
And I'm assuming this would be a nonfiction book, just based on speculation.
It sounds like a dystopian novel.
It does. That's why I ask.
Yeah. Well, I mean, this one guy, he was doing, he built the hospital, the Ebola hospitals. He supervised them. And the question is, what do you do with the waste from these hospitals and the dead bodies? Because the water table is only 2 feet. So you can't bury them. And he also worked on pandemics in Siberia.
Oh, interesting.
Multi-resistant TB. I mean, what do you do about things like that? Or in Iraq, there's a huge case of osteomyelitis. And that's sort of ground zero for these superbugs and rising temperatures and the rest of it. And there have been societies in the past that have collapsed because of global warming, civilizations.
And you know,
I'm not even sure that makes a book, but I think a lot about it.
I also enjoyed your book. I believe it was called Sleeping with the Devil, the one about KSA.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was a good book.
Come on, we got to face it. The Saudis were and the Pakistanis were keeping bin Laden, Khalid Sheikh Mohammed. They were protecting him. I mean, you cannot sit in Abbottabad without the Pakistanis involved, and Gates said they were. And, you know, for a country like Saudi Arabia or Pakistan to protect our number one enemy,
that's not a good sign. He was in Abbottabad, which was like their neighborhood. It was kind of like the West Point of Pakistan. You know, he was in a protected area.
Well, I mean, Pakistan, I've lived there a lot. Is, you know, David, the chokidar, the guy sits out front, reports to ISI, to Pakistani intelligence. Everything, you go out shopping, they come around and question, well, what did that foreigner do? Well, he went out, drove out in this car, this license plate number, and they give a little piece of paper. I've seen him. And same thing applies to Abbottabad. These weird foreigners are living in this very large house and not, you know, they're burning their trash. They're not throwing it out in the street or whatever they do with it. Well, something weird's going on. So they knew somebody in Pakistan, as Gates said. And, you know, just it's a bad thing, I'm telling you, when your allies are protecting your number one enemy.
Well, we've talked about it quite a bit on this podcast, and maybe while we have you here for a moment, do you want to give your take on the controversy around that raid and how all of that went down and we ended up getting bin Laden? I mean, what do you think actually happened there?
Well, I worked a lot with Delta and on assaults and hostage rescue things, and they got to the point after Desert One that they would only go in to a remote area like that with overwhelming force
and air cover,
which we know they did. It was stacked up, but the question is, what's the standoff jamming? It's probably 150 miles. And they had to refuel over the tribal areas. So there was some message went to Pakistan, I'm pretty sure, saying we can do this the hard way or the easy way.
Yeah, yeah.
Because how do you jam the radar at Islamabad International Airport with all that shit in the air? You can't. I mean, and not have the Pakistani Air Force scramble. And if they scramble, that's the last thing you need. Or when there was some, when the military was waved off in Islamabad because the locals called the police when they saw the helicopter crash and burn, as you would, as anybody would. And the police all said, don't worry about it. We know what's going on. The military told us.
And those I've
had people in the White House that were there at the time. I've had people at State Department working for Kerry at the time have told me that flat out that it came as a total surprise to the Pakistanis. I don't understand how, you know, 24 SEALs got ahead of the pack like that. They never have in any operation.
And those fighter jets stayed on the ground that night.
Yeah. And what would you do if the Pakistanis were totally surprised? Or there was a patrol out that night, you know, at Abbottabad. I mean, if there's some guys just pulling out a base and an exercise and, you know, with live ammo and they saw this going on. I don't know. But I'm not, you know, this is not my specialty. All I know is if I were in the White House and I were Gates, I would call up the Pakistani chief of state, defense secretary. I mean, what am I doing? Chief of staff. Yeah, chief of staff, and say, hey, let's don't let this become a problem.
Yeah. Like, we're going to do this. We can destroy your entire fleet of fighter aircraft tonight or not. That's kind of up to you, you know?
Yeah, I mean, that's the only sensible thing to do. I just don't know how that message was passed.
Yeah, I mean, it definitely seems like some sort of assurance was made.
Yeah, I mean, and you have to talk to somebody about the refueling of those Blackhawks, because they either would have had to do it with a FARP.
Yes.
And like 500 guys in the tribal areas, which is not possible without the Pakistani. No, they would have had to do it from the air. And there's a lot of slow-moving aircraft to be flying over a country that wouldn't be picked up by the Air Force. But I'm passing that on secondhand, what people that do this for a living tell me. But I defer to you guys.
Yeah, no, I don't know if those aircraft even had refueling pods for mid-air refueling.
Yeah, I don't know that either.
And they came out, so they had the staging ground in Afghanistan. I mean, a FARP can be thrown up fairly quickly. You just throw some aircraft, fly some helicopters into a area where there's not too many people, offload fuel bladders, and, you know, have a couple of Joes standing by ready to fuel up the aircraft when they land. But I that's just speculative on my part.
Well, in the tribal area, I wouldn't want to go down there with less than 500 Rangers, you know? Seriously.
Yeah.
No, those people are crazy up there. If that's where it would have been, you'd have to look at the map. You certainly wouldn't want to do it clandestinely. You're not going to do that in the tribal areas.
The other thing that I've written about a little bit in the past, what do you make of this whole story that came out of the White House that we buried Sheikh bin Laden at sea?
Oh, I think the problem is that the White House lied from the first moment about that. So it's hard to tell what's true and what's not about that. There was a gunfight with bin Laden and the rest of it. You've heard that. But I think that somebody smart would have said, let's get rid of the body so it doesn't become an issue, and throw them out. I think that's probably the most likely. The Hirsch article is what really caused problems for this whole story, because he made mistakes, and mm-hmm. it was easy to focus on the mistakes.
Yeah, I agree.
And then just take the whole story and push it into conspiracy land.
Yeah.
And that's the best way to kill one of these stories.
Yeah.
Like the phone call from Gates, the Pakistani chief of staff, if it in fact occurred. Because now no one's going to touch that story now, because it got trashed so much.
Yeah, there were aspects of that story, like he made the claim that the SEAL Team 6 operators hacked up bin Laden's body and threw pieces of it off the helicopter. I mean, I don't believe that happened for a moment. But then there are other aspects of it, like that there was a walk-in to the embassy in Islamabad that coughed up bin Laden's location. That actually seems like it's fairly plausible.
Well, you know what? These guys won't move unless they got green eyes on.
Mm-hmm.
You simply don't get some CIA analyst like in Zero Dark Thirty saying, you know, we follow this courier here and we think he's here and blah, blah, blah. Come on. The military will not act going into a hostile country. And Pakistan is hostile on that kind of intelligence.
So someone had eyes on.
McRaven's going to say no. We'll go in if we know he's there. And I think the walk-in started this whole thing. And I've heard his name, and he's relocated here in the United States.
Huh.
And he started the whole thing. Then it was a matter of assembling the proof. Now, that's, I think, what that doctor was arrested for. They were trying to get DNA samples from that house. And they were going to send him in on the supposed, you know, vaccination campaign, and he gets arrested. And then they found a different way to prove that was bin Laden. And then, of course, you had the overhead of bin Laden walking at night, and you could measure him from the overhead that he was 6'4", something like that.
Yeah.
And then, so you start putting it all together, and then you know, then the second piece was take care of the Pakistani Air Force.
And then the interesting addendum to all of it, of course, is that Dewey Clarage had all those, you know, private intel networks that he was running along the Pakistani border. And how did that play in or not play in? It starts to get confusing.
Yeah, I think that's just, you know, they don't, you're not going to get JSOC to move on speculative intelligence. So right, when Obama right. said, oh, you know, 50% chance he's there, I just don't think he would ever do that.
So you think
no,
we had
military would they just say flat out no?
You think JSOC got eyes on before we sent the
some sort? Yeah, yeah, they had some proof, whatever that was, DNA or something before they went in. Because the last thing JSOC needs to do is raid an empty house that high profile.
Yeah, especially if you get a couple helicopters shot down and operators killed, and it turns out to be a dry hole.
Yeah, you would just wreck the, you know, reputation of JSOC and the military and the White House. That's my armchair view of the whole thing.
It's one of those things that's like almost it's contemporary history, but it's like already lost to history because it's been so muddled.
Yeah, like I said, I've seen people since and said, you know, what is, you know, I've asked people in the White House, well, what is the range of a Black Hawk? You know, I don't know. And I said, well, it couldn't fly all the way from Afghanistan to Abbottabad. I know that much without refueling. And then I ask these questions. They have no answers for them. So, you know, they tell them I'm absolutely wrong, that there's it occurred as described by the White House afterwards.
I don't believe that.
I still find that hard to believe.
I don't believe it.
Yeah. Nobody in the military believes it that thinks about this.
Well, this has been a fascinating conversation. I think we covered a lot of ground. I really appreciate you going almost a full hour with us. I don't know really what to promote from the great Robert Baer, because as I said, The Perfect Kill, 21 Laws of for Assassins is the last book that you put out. But anything else that you want to get out there that you're working on or where people could find you, if anywhere?
You know, I do stuff for CNN, you know, comment on.
Sure.
I like doing it because commenting on the obvious that those guys in Sri Lanka, somebody taught them how to make those bombs.
Yes.
They didn't just get on the internet and figure that out to make 9 of them go off nearly simultaneously.
Absolutely.
That's a bridge too far.
Yeah, and I know it was a long time ago, Bob, but like I said, I read your memoir years ago before I joined the military, so it was like, probably, when did it come out? 2000, 2001?
It came out after 9/11, so it came to 2002.
2002. Okay, so I must have read it when I was just joining. But what's the name of it so people can go find it?
It's See No Evil.
See No Evil.
It was made into
the
movie Syriana with George Clooney.
Good movie, too. But it's Bob's memoir is definitely worth giving a read. There are some hair-raising stories in there.
Yeah, well, I think I got at it.
Yeah.
CIA hates the book, but I guess that's an accomplishment, right?
Comes with the territory.
Yeah.
Well, we appreciate it. Thanks for going along with us.
All right. Thanks. Bye.
Yeah, thank you, Bob.
Thank you.
Bye.
Great interview with Bob Baer there. I mean, to me, that's an A-list guest, and really appreciate having him on. Be sure to check out Crate Club. It's a club for men, by men, of gear handpicked by special operations veterans. We have the Dash 1 crate, the Pro crate, and for those looking for the holy grail of gear subscriptions, our premium crate. These are all available at crateclub.us, and right now we're running an extremely limited promotion of 20% off for all Soft Rep Radio listeners. It's the biggest discount we've ever made available, and we don't know how long we can keep this promotion live, so get on it right now. That's crateclub.us, coupon code SOFREP for 20% off any gearbox. Sign up today. Also, as a reminder for those who are listening, now is the time to sign up for the Spec Ops channel, our channel that offers the most exclusive shows, documentaries, and interviews covering the most exciting military content today. The Spec Ops channel premiere show Training Cell follows former Special Operations Forces as they participate in the most advanced training in the country, everything from shooting schools, defensive driving, jungle and winter warfare, climbing, and much more. Again, you can watch this content by subscribing to the Spec Ops Channel at specopschannel.com and take advantage of a membership for only $4.99 a month. That's specopschannel.com. Sign up today. Last, if you're not already signed up at thenewsrep.com, you've got to get on board. Expert reporting and actionable intelligence from your favorite writers you've heard on here, like Jack Murphy, of course, next to me, and Alex Hollings, who was just on with us, and the many guest writers who pop up as well. Unlimited access to NewsRep on any device, unlimited access to the app, join the War Room community, invitations to our exclusive events, and it's all ad-free for members. We have a trial offer up right now where you can get 4 weeks for only $1.99. Sign up now at thenewsrep.com. That's thenewsrep.com. By the way, for those not in the know, we have our own SoftRep Radio app that you can download for free on iPhone or Android. And our homepage, as always, SoftRepRadio.com, where you can see our full archive of shows. As always, keep up with us at SoftRep Radio as well. Pick up Murphy's Law if you haven't already.
I'm running around doing press for it.
Yep. So get on it. It's getting stellar reviews thus far, as you've heard.
Yeah, it's been well received so far. It's pretty cool to see people connect with it. So
yeah, good. And I think it's because of the honesty of it. So at Ian Scotto on Twitter to follow me, at Jack Murphy RGR, and plenty of great guests on the horizon. So thanks as always, guys.
You've been listening to Soft Rep Radio. New episodes up every Wednesday and Friday. Follow the show on Instagram and Twitter at Soft Rep Radio.